Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 6 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. We've just celebrated the 50th anniversary of Woodstock, the most iconic music festival to ever take place in the United States. Next year, we'll celebrate the 50th anniversary of the Wadena Rock Festival, arguably the most iconic music festival in our state's history. But music festivals are far from a thing of the past. In fact, we seem to be in something of a golden age for music festivals. This hour, we'll explore music festival culture, and we want to hear from you. Describe music festival culture, what you love, what you hate, in 6 words or less. Tweet us at Iowa Public Radio or email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org, and we will share your responses throughout the hour. We're going to start the hour with Woodstock. In the summer of 1969, Max Wilkening was living in a bus he called Hal outside of Sigourney, Iowa. He started up Hal and drove out to a dairy farm in Bethel, New York, and the rest is history. Max is on the line with me now. Hi, Max.
Hi, how you doing?
Great. Thank you so much for talking with me today.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
So take me back to the summer of 1969. What was going on in your life?
Bought a school bus because my house was being overridden by people I didn't even know, partying and so forth. So I decided my best way to go is to get my house on wheels so I didn't have to go through that problem. I bought it from a construction company and spent the early part of the summer at Lake Yenrogus doing all the painting, and got a job at Central College in Pella, installing lavatories, vanities in the girls' dorm, where I met these guys from New York who were there going to college. Found out about the festival, and one of the guys rode with me, helped drive and put the gas in to get there.
All right, so you're basically taking your house with you, driving all the way out to New York, but you didn't actually know where you were going, did you?
Well, I thought it was at the town of Woodstock. That's where it was originally supposed to be. So we cut across Pennsylvania and went up, avoiding all the traffic from New York City, went to Woodstock, and they said, no, there's nothing like that going on here. It's about 50, 60 miles south of here. So that's when we drove on down there. The first place they parked me was in this big hayfield, and I started walking down the road towards the stage. I'm walking and walking, and I finally asked somebody how far it was to the stage, and they said, oh, it's a mile or so. And I didn't even go. I just turned around and went back to the bus, and I wasn't going to walk a mile or two every time I wanted to eat or go to sleep or whatever, you know. So I just turned around, went back, and talked to a police officer directing traffic, and I told a little white lie. I had to tell 3 white lies to get to where I was parked. I went to this police officer and said, look, can you help me out? I have a whole busload of crippled kids. How can I get closer to the stage? Well, he whispers the directions in my ear so nobody else could hear, of course, and it took me a couple, 3 hours.
He didn't think to look in the window of your bus or anything like that?
I didn't have it with me. I already had it
parked. Okay. I see.
So then now I'm driving behind the stage, and here comes the second white lie. This guy comes up and asks me where my tickets are. And, well, of course, I didn't have any tickets. And it was real windy that Friday morning. And I said, well, the wind blew them out the window. I said, do you want me to turn around and go home? And he looked at me, looked at the bus and the paintings. He says, okay, go on. So now I'm driving up the road to the intersection that went to the out to where I was parked the first time. Well, now they're trying to shoot me out the other way. And now, you know how far I'd have to go to find a place to park now if I was a mile 2 hours ago. So anyway, I said, here's the last little white lie. I said, look, my people have a place waiting for me at this other parking lot, first one I was at. They have a spot for the bus to be parked. And if I don't go there, I'll probably never be able to find them. And he looked at me and looked at the bus. And said, okay, go on. So now I'm driving down the road, and I look down to the left, and there's the stage. I look over to the right, and there's a pizza vendor, ice cream vendor, and a Pepsi vendor. I go, well, music, food, pulled right over next to the concession stands and parked, and that's where I stayed for the whole 4 days.
Wow. So you were right there in the thick of it with your bus. And of course, a lot of people in remembering Woodstock, a lot of people have been sharing very fond memories, but also they were camping out in a field. A lot of people didn't actually bring any kind of gear, so they were really living outside. But you had your whole house with you.
I had my house. There wasn't anybody out of the 500,000 people that were there that had a better setup. All the other campers and motorhomes and what have you were parked in a field behind the stage, way back behind the stage. And it just took perfect timing and, like I say, three little white lies to get where I was. But so now me and the guy that rode with me are sitting on top of the bus watching. They're still building the stage and sound towers and everything. We're sitting up there watching them build a stage, and these two drop-dead gorgeous chicks come walking down the road, and they stop, and they look up, point at my bus and the paintings and everything, and I hollered down at them, well, do you girls have a place to stay? Oh, can we stay with you? Oh, yeah, no problem. So now I got my music, I got my food, I got my chick. Let's have it. Bring it on.
Wow. Well, and your bus wound up really becoming an iconic image for all of Woodstock. You were in so many of the photographs, and millions and millions of people have seen pictures of you and your bus. It became a real hub of activity, not just for you and the guy that went with you and a couple of ladies that you met, but this was a place that a lot of people wanted to be, right?
Oh, exactly. When it started raining and the weather got really bad, I just went down inside my living room, sat on my couch, and watched it all unfold. Of course, I had like, I don't know how many, probably 3-4 girls with their little babies who were out in the cold rain and got their blankets and everything wet. So I gave them refuge. They were back on my bed. And so, yeah, I had a heat in there, and I dried their blankets out. And then everything was fine.
So you became a place of refuge for some people. You also sort of held the gate of getting up on your roof. Why was it so desirable for so many people to get on the roof of your bus, Max?
Well, that you could see the stage then. Otherwise, there were people in front of you, and you really couldn't see the stage. And so the people were trying to get up there all around the bus, trying to climb up, scale it and everything, but they'd just fall off. There was just no way to get up there except for going the front bumper, then the front fender, then the firewall, and then I would pull them back on up the rest of the way. And before I would even consider them coming up, they had to be dripping with personality, have dressed, you know, the right way, and then they had to either go get me pizza, Pepsi, or ice cream, whatever I was hungry for at the time. And then they could get up in the, what I called the box seats.
I see. So you were king of the bus there. How long were you at Woodstock?
The gatekeeper. Yeah. I was pretty much the gatekeeper.
Yeah. How long were you at Woodstock?
I got there Friday morning and left Monday morning after Jimi Hendrix did 11 songs.
Wow. What is your favorite memory?
Oh, boy, there's so many. Probably favorite memories, probably Sly and the Family Stone's performance. They just rocked the whole place. I mean, it was just unbelievable. And The Who, of course, and 10 Years After. And I flew back for the 40-year reunion in 2009.
Oh, really?
And they built a multi-million-dollar amphitheater on the original site. There's a big museum with a movie theater. You can go in and sit down in a movie theater and watch clips of it. And it was just totally awesome. I mean, it was just well worth going back for.
What, you know, we've spent so much time this summer remembering when and hearing from people who are at the festival. But what made that experience so special to you?
Well, just the fact that I had the best seat in the house was, you know, I mean, nobody else had their house there. They were handing out big plastic things to, you know, keep you the rain from getting you soaked. But it still was a mess. I mean, it got pretty muddy. But of course, I didn't have any problem with that. I'm just going in and out of my house.
Why do you think the atmosphere was so unique? What was it about that moment in time and that place in time and that music that made for this moment that really hasn't been able to be replicated?
Well, I think it was basically middle-class white kids were the only ones that could really afford the tickets at the time. And then, of course, when it became a free concert, then everybody came. But the majority were, you know, middle-class white kids that weren't, you know, out to cause any problems. They just wanted to have fun and listen to music and get high, whatever they had to do, you know.
Interesting. And so, Max, that one troubles me a little bit, but you feel like maybe it was the privilege of the audience that made it a safer space?
Absolutely, yeah. I really feel that. I've been to other concerts, of course, and of course the Altamont, the Rolling Stones singing, where they had the motorcycle gang at security. That was a big fiasco, and it was just to get a half a million people thrown together in the bad weather and the lack of food, the lack of shelter. It was just everybody came together to help each other, and nobody was trying to be selfish or anything like that. It was just totally amazing.
Well, Max Wilkening, thank you so much for talking with me.
Oh, my pleasure. My pleasure.
Max Wilkening remembering what it was like to be at Woodstock 50 years ago in his bus, a bus he named Hal. We will continue our conversation in a moment talking about music festival culture in Iowa, and we would love to hear from you. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Time is passing, I grow older, things are happening fast. All I have to hold on to is a simple song at last. Let me hear you say,
it's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about music festivals and music festival culture. We want to hear your thoughts. In six words or less, we would love for you to tell us how you would describe a music festival. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio, or you can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Coming up in a few minutes, I'll talk to Jaron Hart of the Des Moines Music Coalition and organizer for 8035. But we're going to start in an area that's a little more rural. The Hinterland Music Festival just celebrated its fifth year, held in St. Charles, Iowa, a small town in Madison County, just about 25 miles south of Des Moines. Hinterland has become one of the biggest music festivals in the state, and founder and organizer Sam Summers is here with me. Hello, Sam.
Hi, how you doing?
Great. Let's go back in time before that first festival. We'll talk about that first festival. Let's go back in time before. What was the concept behind Hinterland for you?
Yeah, so I think it was a lot of different styles of music that I personally was listening to, but also that I was kind of recognizing Iowans and, you know, specifically Central Iowans here were, you know, really supporting. So we started a lot of these bands out in the clubs, you know, whether it be Vaudeville Muse or Woolies or even up to Hoyt Sherman and Nightfall on the River. And, you know, we just saw support on every level for it. And so I wouldn't say it was like a goal to get a music festival going, but I felt like we had a great opportunity to put together this two-day festival. It allowed me to kind of, you know, put together this, you know, curated festival of bands that I like, and then make it kind of a camping experience as well. So kind of playing into, you know, the demographic of the people that support that kind of music.
Well, Hinterland has grown dramatically over the last 5 years. You've added another day, or at least you did this summer. But I want to go back to that first year, which was very nearly a disaster because of floodwaters. So take us back there and tell us what you learned.
Right. Yeah. The first year was very chaotic. It's when I try to think about it, it was really about how do we preserve the festival. So we were, our original year was scheduled in Waterworks Park, downtown Des Moines. And we got some, you know, unseasonable weather, and it just would not stop raining in August. And it just, you know, we got to the point Wednesday, where we're typically loading in our stage on Wednesday. And we got to that point, stage is pulling up and water levels are rising. And I'm communicating with river level people and meteorologists and et cetera, et cetera. And we just made the call here. I had reserved this other location down in St. Charles where we're at now. I was like, hey, we're coming down. Like, we're ready to go. I don't know where stuff's going, but we're going to set the stage right on this piece of cement. And then it was just a lot of people on my team making, taking initiative and making decisions here on the fly. And, you know, it may not have been a perfectly produced festival, but I did hear from multiple bands that, you know, because they don't really know what's going on. They're just like, we thought this is where it was supposed to be from the get-go. I mean, you know, so to me, it was like, okay, well, that means we did a great job getting that done. And that was so important that first year, because if we wouldn't have produced the festival, then it wasn't going to happen. You know, it's not like in our fifth year, if something were like this would have happened and, you know, it's just a flooding or whatever. People know that what the festival's been like, but when you're in your first year, I mean, that's basically the end of it if you're not going to produce it. So, I think having the backup location really worked out. And obviously, you know, we've stayed down there and we really liked that location.
Right. Well, and that's one of the things that people love to talk about when they talk about why they love Hinterland so much is because of the location and the environment that it takes place in. So does that feel like a stroke of good luck now?
When I'm listening to these bands on stage, it sounds perfect to kind of be in that, you know, wide open area where you can see the stars and, there's not any sort of noise pollution from anything else out there. And it really allows us to, camp more people as well, which is great.
When people think about the culture of a music festival, I think they often think about the experience of being there as a festival goer. But you're also building a culture for the bands that you bring in. Tell me how you built the culture of Hinterland for the bands and how you conceived of it. What's the concept behind it?
Right. Yeah. So making sure the bands are happy is one of the most important things. You know, second place or maybe tie for first with making sure the fan is happy. So when they, my goal from the beginning was to have artists that would, you know, there's a lot of festivals out there. So have a festival that people talk about. Ways you can do that, provide great catering for the artists. So that was an easy one. We did that. But also, I think people like working Hinterland. And so those people are the ones that are in front of the artists every day, our stage managers, our production managers, our runners, on-site runners, all that. Like, they're the ones that are talking to the artist. And so when they are happy and they're positive and having a great time, you know, truly having a good time, then, you know, that kind of resonates with the artist. And we get feedback. I'll read feedback. And the first thing I see on there is really great staff. Everybody was, you know, really happy, you know, really fun show. And we have had, you know, there's been a few artists that have been kind of breakout artists that I really wanted to invest in and make sure their experience is great. And so, like, this year, one of those artists was Maggie Rogers. And after the festival, like, got a note from her manager, like, well, it was actually during the festival. And he was like, hey, Maggie said this is her best festival look of the year.
Over the past, really the past decade or so, we've seen music festival culture in Iowa grow in some new ways. Why do you think this is taking off in such a big way in the state?
Yeah, I can speak for my festival. I think obviously the fans are the ones that support it, right? So booking a lineup, to me, I feel like that's an easy part. Anybody can do that. But really taking care of the customer, making sure they have a good experience is hands down the most important thing. And I think one thing that some, you know,
some of the bigger festivals and you know, national festivals that they kind of miss the bar on is a level of transparency that people do really want and require, you know, for purchasing a product or whatever. And I feel like from the get-go, I'm not a big festival guy. I don't travel for festivals, but the reason I didn't do that is because I felt like there was a lot of smoke and mirrors, and then there was also, you know, not a lot of, you know, transparency. And so I tried to make it so, you know, our festival, there's no secrets. We're announcing our lineup from the get-go. Everybody knows exactly what they're purchasing. You know, our prices aren't increasing in tiers or anything like that. And then to me, that creates, you know, a fan that wants to be there, not someone that bought this, you know, early on sale ticket blind lineup thing, and then they get the lineup and they don't like it. I mean, that's how Iowans are. You know, we like to be honest and open, and to me, it's working really well for me. So
would you travel to go to Hinterland if you weren't already in Iowa?
You know, that's tough. I've got a 2-year-old, so I would have to, you know, really plan. I think this is the kind of thing that I would go to. It's a you know, kind of a niche festival where, you know, it's highly curated. People, you know, the lineup from start to finish are bands that I like. I think, you know, I might be a little biased, you know, being that I book it, but. You know, there are festivals that are kind of booked in the same ways. You know, one of them, there's a festival called Eclair, and I was absolutely obsessed with it. You know, so different than some other festivals. So,
well, Sam, thank you so much for talking with me.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Sam Summers is the organizer and founder of the Hinterland Music Festival. Next, we're going to 8035, the festival that you could argue really sparked this renaissance in music festivals when it was launched 13 years ago. It takes place every summer in downtown Des Moines. The festival is almost all volunteer run and offers a lot of free music in addition to the higher profile acts at stages that require passes. Jaron Hart is executive director of the Des Moines Music Coalition. That's the nonprofit behind this, and one of the organizers for 8035. Hello, Jaron.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, thank you so much for being here. And let's talk about what, from your perspective, makes 8035 special.
Oh, gosh. Well, I think, you know, there are many things. The fact that it takes place in, you know, downtown Des Moines, in the heart of the city, I think definitely plays in. You know, that the fact that so many people, you know, are invested in 8035 as, you know, a community event, you know, from sponsors to, you know, festival goers to the hundreds of volunteers that show up, some of them, you know, every year for the past, you know, 12 years. You know, I think that it's more than just a music festival. It's a tradition for many area residents, and it's become one of the city's most anticipated summer events.
Why is it important that this is volunteer run and that there's this nonprofit behind it? The idea of raising money to put on a music festival, not making money from a music festival.
Sure. Well, I think that it just kind of, you know, goes back to perhaps, you know, the mission of the DMMC, which is, you know, to support and cultivate Iowa's music economy. You know, with an overarching vision of establishing and maintaining Des Moines as a nationally recognized music city. You know, I think that, you know, the point of it is to, you know, give as many people as possible, you know, access to music that they wouldn't normally have.
Well, earlier we were taking a look back at Woodstock 50 years ago, and the person we were talking to about going to Woodstock revealed an uglier side of Woodstock when he was saying, well, you know, it was white kids who could afford the tickets and weren't out to make trouble. 8035 has made a real point of making sure that there are free stages so people who can't afford to buy passes can still enjoy the festival. Why is that so important to you?
I think that that's important because, you know, again, it provides access. You know, everybody can attend. And there are, you know, this year we moved to two stages in the paid area where, you know, historically there have been one, because, you know, I do think it's important to add value to and for the ticket buyer. But, you know, it's just so important to have those, those free stages, you know, both for the audience and, you know, for just accessibility, and also for, you know, local and regional artists to reach, you know, a wider fan base.
With 8035, with so many stages, you're bringing so many different acts. How do you decide what kind of music to feature? What from your perspective is really the overall theme that ties it all together?
Yeah, I think that, you know, certainly indie, you know, the indie music. And again, you know, when it was founded all those years ago, the vision was trying to book bands that were not, you know, coming through Des Moines or, you know, even Iowa, you know, and bringing in more diversity. And a lot of that was, you know, these indie acts and, you know, also, you know, some jam bands. And, you know, we've also moved to include more hip hop. And, you know, I guess, you know, it's important to be reflective of, you know, the community that is attending.
How do you feel 8035 has changed the conversation in Iowa about music? How has it impacted the music scene?
I think that a lot of people really appreciate the free, you know, the free aspect, but also, you know, the lineup, the diversity in the lineup, and also, you know, the fact that we do feature so many regional and local bands. Also, you know, the Gen Z stage, which is an opportunity for, you know, teens and tweens to perform live, and, you know, we get to work with and collaborate with, you know, incredible groups like, you know, Des Moines Girls Rock and Station One Records. And, you know, I think that is another really important element that people, you know, really respect and appreciate.
How do you think the music scene in Des Moines has changed over the last decade? I mean, whether it's because of 8035 or this is just obviously a part of that puzzle, but how have you seen the scene evolve?
Well, I've only been in Des Moines for 2 years, but I hear a lot about this from, you know, people who founded the festival and just, you know, all the people who are involved in producing it. From what I understand, you know, 10 or so years ago, there wasn't a lot going on in Des Moines as far as, you know, entertainment options. I hear a lot of this Dead Moines thing. And so, you know, I think that the festival certainly spurred, you know, and accomplished its mission and vision of bringing new and different acts to Des Moines that weren't coming through. You know, the first year, the Flaming Lips and the Roots headlined. And, you know, that's just incredible to me. But I do think, you know, the music landscape has changed so much, you know, and even just in the 2 years I've been here, you know, now we have, you know, Waterworks Park and, you know, all of the things that, all of the different bands that are playing there. It's just, you know, it's no longer, again, that, you know, that Dead Moines concept. There's entertainment options and venues, you know, are flourishing. You've got Hoyt Sherman and all the great things that, you know, First Fleet's doing.
With these other music festivals starting after 8035 started, I mean, Hinterland is not very far down the road. It's become huge. Is there any concern about the market getting saturated?
You know, I don't think so right now. I think that there's, you know, there's plenty of room for, you know, for everyone right now. You know, 515 Alive has kind of the EDM, you know, hip hop thing, and you know, the things that Hinterland, you know, are doing that's a very kind of niche festival and a destination festival. And, you know, 8035 is covering those, you know, the more indie acts. You know, I think right now, you know, I don't foresee, you know, an issue right now.
Look ahead for us. Obviously, there have been changes. And as you said, you've been here just a couple of years, but there were changes at 8035 this summer. Are there things that you're thinking about for the future?
Oh, sure. You know, we made a lot of changes to the layout this year just because, you know, we had outgrown our, you know, our footprint. And so we moved over to Grand. And I think that for the most part, the response was positive. And I think that, you know, we're the point of doing all of that was, of course, to set us up for future growth. And, you know, there's a lot of exciting things that we're thinking about for 2020 and beyond. I think there's a lot of room to grow.
Well, we will be excited to see what comes next. Jaren Hart, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Jaren Hart, Executive Director of the Des Moines Music Coalition, one of the organizers for 8035. We're asking listeners to give us their six words that describe a music festival. Chelsea, I'm guessing, was at Hinterland, and Chelsea says, Brandi Carlile rocked my face off. We also have these six words from Susan: watch faves and find new faves. Share your six words or less about music festival culture with us. Tweet us at Iowa Public Radio or send an email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with six race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about music festival culture in Iowa, and we want to hear from you. Why do you go to music festivals? What's your favorite? What's your favorite memory from a music festival? What do you think makes Iowa a unique place for music festivals? You can give us a call, 866-780-9100, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And we're still collecting your six words that describe music festival culture. You can tweet us that at Iowa Public Radio. And of course, as we've talked about this hour, we've heard a lot about Woodstock this summer, but next summer we'll be marking the 50th anniversary of arguably the most iconic music festival to ever take place in Iowa, the Wadena Rock Festival. Iowa Public Radio's Rick Fredrickson did a 40th anniversary piece on the festival. Here's a clip from Jared Blue, who took pictures at the festival for the Fayette County paper.
As I rode in the tombstone on my horse's back, I saw what I relate to you going on behind my back.
They had some of the top entertainers at that time. They were flying them into Waterloo, Iowa, and then driving them up. But the stage was massive.
Mason Prophet sang his anti-war song, Hangman. The performance schedule included Leon Russell, the Everly Brothers, Little Richard, Johnny Winter, The Guess Who, REO Speedwagon, and Poco. No actual recordings from Wadena are believed to have survived, but many of the bands and the songs they played are posted on YouTube. Illegal drugs were part of the scene and were sold openly: LSD, pills, and marijuana.
All right, that was just a little bit from Rick Fredrickson's piece remembering the 40th anniversary of the Wadena Rock Festival. Music festivals tend to be a little more controlled these days, and it seems that we have more music festivals in Iowa every year. We asked Paul Lasley, professor of sociology at Iowa State University and bluegrass musician, to help us explore the culture of music festivals. Hello, Paul.
Good morning, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Well, it's a delightful program. it takes you down memory lane to think that Woodstock is 50, and we've got Wadena coming up. For those of us post-World War II baby boomers that sort of grew up in this era, it was a fascinating program, Charity.
Well, thanks, Paul. So take us down your memory lane. What were some of your early music festival memories?
Well, coming from rural North Missouri, we didn't have... at least to my knowledge, these large-scale venues were certainly not an option for me. But in fact, I was raised in a bluegrass festival world, and the bluegrass festivals tend to be much smaller venues. But there are some real commonalities, as we've heard this morning, some commonalities between whether you're talking about a small community-based, and there are several dozen bluegrass festivals across Iowa, but But, of course, you've highlighted some of the major, what I'd call large festivals, 8035, Hinterland. And it's not too far away. The Summerfest in Milwaukee, Wisconsin is allegedly maybe the largest music festival. Summerfest estimates they bring in between 800,000 and a million people.
Wow.
But there's some common elements across the festivals. Whether you're talking about a community-based or a bluegrass festival with small local bands or these large ones, and the commonality is experience. You know, if you just want to listen to music, you can go to any radio station or go buy a CD.
Put in your earbuds and download it on your phone, right?
Right. So it's not about, actually, it's not really about listening to the music because it's widely available, but it's the experience. And you know, we're starting off with Woodstock and Max's interview this morning. It really was about the experience of that first Woodstock. I've read where they expected maybe 150,000 people and about 500,000 showed up over that 3 or 4 day period. They were not prepared for that kind of a crowd, but it's facing that adversity together. The experience.
The rain and the mud and all of it. That's so interesting. So even if it's a small festival or one of these giant festivals, you're saying it's about that community that is created in those moments, a sort of a kinship that you feel with whoever else is there?
I think so. In some cases, it may be both positive experiences, but it can also be negative experiences. Seeing your favorite band on stage or a musician that you know for the first time, that's a positive experience. But also dealing with the adversity of rain or lightning or thunderstorms, but as I have observed festivals, it really is about the experience of attendees sharing their experiences, and it may be sharing their experiences that keeps them coming back. And we certainly heard that this morning with Hinterland, talking about the importance of keeping everybody happy, both the performers as well as the fans. Keeping them happy, fan support is terribly important. But my observations oftentimes is it's this sharing. In most of these festivals, there's camping, and people camping together, not only sharing their favorite recipes, their favorite music, their food, their beverage, helping each other set up a tent, or if it's muddy, unsticking an RV that's mired down in the mud. It's really that community that comes together over a relatively short period of time, 3 to 5 days. And I've always sort of been fascinated. Many of the bluegrass festivals, while there are bands that are playing on stage, oftentimes people gather around a campfire and simply jam. And they play sort of what I call the standard bluegrass songs.
That's interesting. So it's a shorthand in some ways, a shortcut to getting together with other musicians that you can play with. And I imagine, I'm not a bluegrass musician, but I imagine that can be a little bit hard to find in your day-to-day life. So bringing you into that environment is pretty special.
That's right. And not only is it bringing people together that share a common love for a particular genre of music, but it cuts across generations. And I always marvel. I mean, I learned to play as a beginner by sitting with more accomplished musicians. I'm still learning, by the way. But as I listen to these jamming groups, I see young people just starting with playing alongside of old-timers that are very accomplished, seeing them nurture and encourage each other. And it cuts across what I'd call socioeconomic status. You have people driving $300,000 RVs and people sleeping in tents. But when you get when you're in a jam session, social economic status makes no difference. It's whether you can hit the right chord, stay on rhythm, if you know. And so it's a fascinating. Now that does lead to sort of an interesting question that I've toyed around a bit, is what's the difference between a concert and a festival? Because some of these are really outdoor concerts, and mm-hmm. I've gone to some of those, like a Jimmy Buffett concert.
Sure.
But there's still that element of community, even though people may not be bringing their own instruments to jam. And you have vendors, whether they're selling food or CDs or T-shirts or posters. It's really about the experience. And in preparation for today's interview, I did a little bit of online searching as to what the status of festivals are, and there's wide estimates, but it's estimated that there are about 800 major music festivals in the United States this past year. About 32 million people go to at least one festival a year. So that is a big business, and as you've indicated and with our previous guest this morning, that it's growing very rapidly in Iowa. Estimates, you know, this is a multi-billion dollar industry when you take all the entertainment world. And I think it's because people are looking for that sort of community that comes together, maybe temporary community or community of interest for 3 to 5 days, and then people disperse.
Right. A feeling of going to summer camp, even though you're a grown-up, kind of like that. Well, and I've observed, you know, I do a lot of camping, and when I wind up in campgrounds, I often see people walking around the campground, making conversation, you know, with other campers. And it occurred to me once that people go camping because they want to feel like they live in Iowa. I want to share some of these six words
sure.
that some of our listeners have shared with us from Sheila in Ankeny. My six words to describe a musical festival are ears hear, eyes see, soul rejoices.
Wow.
And then from Tristan, we have very, 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 very fun.
Well, we got your words in. There's six words. Yeah,
absolutely. Let's go to the phones. Tyler with a not so good experience. Tyler in Sioux City. Hello, Tyler.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
So I wanted to reflect on my experience at Hinterland Music Festival since speaking about the Iowa music festival scene. And at Hinterland Music Festival, I felt like what you were getting for the price of that, unless you were to pay for those high-level tiers that were extremely pricey to get up to those next levels and into those VIP packages, and even just the regular tickets being pretty spendy, I felt like just getting the general tickets out there and the general camping out there, you were left with being like almost like roughing it, like putting you out on a rough patch of ground to camp on to try and make do with, and putting you out, and just the general area in general for people who are walking around and going around to the festival. I feel that the festival grounds could have been tended to a lot better, because there was a lot of ruts out there, and a lot of points in time where I found myself tripping almost every other step and rolling my ankle, and I was just thinking the whole time, you know, if they don't tend to that festival ground better, somebody out there is going to get hurt. You know, there's there's little kids out here that the rust are going to hurt a lot worse than me. And
so, Tyler, you felt like there was a real socioeconomic disparity. If you didn't have the money, you couldn't have nearly as nice an experience. Is that what you're saying?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Because when you would go to those other VIP camping grounds, because they had a side stage out there at Hinterland at the end of the night where you had to walk through the VIP campground to get to. And they had nice, flat, smooth turf out there. Like, it was just a huge, huge, huge difference between the general camping ground and the camping ground for those who paid for the next VIP tier.
So I have to ask you, Tyler, before I let you go, and we're almost out of time, but Paul was putting forward the idea that maybe people are brought together through the adversity of being at a music festival. Did you feel closer to your fellow campers because you weren't happy and you were all experiencing these poor quality environment together?
I feel like, yeah, there is somewhat of a sense of a community with going through that experience. But at the same time, I feel like I paid a lot of money for that, for what I think it, compared to other festivals, which I've paid the same amount of money for, or even festivals that I paid less money for.
Okay.
And
well, Tyler, we are going to let you go because we're almost out of time, but I think we get your point. Also, on the other hand, the Gene had a better experience at Hinterland. He says his six words are Hinterland, music, venue, sound, staff, superb. But I mean, what Tyler was saying, that's the kind of thing that keeps a lot of people away from music festivals. There's definitely that opportunity for being uncomfortable. You're outside for maybe a couple of days, right, Paul?
Well, it is, you know, and of course, I'm sorry that one caller didn't have a good experience. And, you know, we probably all could reflect on festivals where we were disappointed either with the lineup of speakers or there were too darn many mosquitoes or a hailstorm came through or a tent fell down. But again, I think that many people continue to pursue those festivals in some way in hopes of joy, of being exhilarated by a band,
right.
But also they reflect on the fun time, the experiences, the people they meet. And some families, the festival becomes almost an extended family reunion. And, you know, we could talk about some of the older established festivals like the Bic Beiderbecke Jazz Festival, where the same families come together, and certainly my family. So family and community, and these are all about experiences.
Well, Paul, we are out of time. We could talk for a lot longer, but thank you so much for coming on the show today.
It was a great show, Charity. Thank you for having me.
Paul Lasley, professor of sociology at Iowa State University and bluegrass musician. We've been talking about music festivals this hour on Talk of Iowa. The show is produced by Shirley Wong. Lindsay Moon today made a guest production appearance for us. Rick Brewer, Caitlin Harrop, and Dennis Reese. You can get in touch with us anytime. Talk of Iowa at iowapublicradio.org. And please subscribe to our podcast. Search for Talk of Iowa wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa.
I can't see by your coat, my friend. From the other side.